want to, before I begin the lesson, share with you a conversation that I had Friday night. I was at a ball game in Monroe, Louisiana. Our son-in-law is a coach there, and we try to make at least one of their ball games a year. And there was many folks there that there was no place to sit, so I was standing beside the stands watching the ball game. And there was a fellow standing beside me, and he stood there for a long time. And I kind of, after a little while, got to feeling a little self-conscious, you know, about somebody standing beside me. So I introduced myself to him, and turns out that he was the Baptist preacher for the First Baptist Church in Monroe, Louisiana. And he started talking to me, and it was, I thought, a really interesting conversation. And he first told me that he had quit preaching recently because he had had a heart procedure, and he said, I was laying there in the hospital, had a heart cath, and he said, you know what I thought? He said, I've got three children at home, and I thought, you know, Jesus died for these people, and I'm not going to. And so the following Sunday, he got up in the pulpit, and he told them that. And then he said, this is my last Sunday with you. And he had his doctorate degree, and so he began counseling. And we won't go into all of that beyond that, but the thing that interested, one of the things that really interested me is he said, you know, the pressures, talk about the pressures of preaching. And he brought up, the first thing he brought up was he said, you know, all the pressures of all the choreography and all this music that's happening. And he said, I just got burned out and I got tired of having to constantly come up with all of this music, you know, and all the time. And then he asked me, you know, who I was and what I did, and so that led that led to more conversation about music, you know, and so I really thought that was really a worthwhile conversation. And he then said, you know, he said, I finally got myself where I could preach out of the New International Version. And he said, and then 2011, they came out with this gender, what do they call it? Yeah, no gender version and gender neutral version. And he said, and I'm not going to preach out of a Bible that's gender neutral. And he said, so I'm just, you know, I told him I was going back to my King James Version. And I thought this conversation was really interesting. And I wanted to tell him that he needed to come to the Woodlands and hear some singing the way that God intended for it to be. And I really do think if someone hears really good, enthusiastic, four-part harmony gospel singing, that it would be hard for them to go back to an instrument of any kind, don't you? Thank you, Sonny, for all the time and energy and effort you put into it. It's a real asset to us, and it's a real lift to me. I want to give credit for the basis of this lesson to a book that was given to me by my son-in-law, Stephen Fitzhugh, who's a Christian husband and dad and coach and deacon and also church youth director in Monroe, Louisiana. And the book is entitled Do Hard Things. And it's written by a pair of twins, teenage boys, Alex and Brett Harris, who are homeschooled in Portland, Oregon. And it's written as a challenge for teenagers to not allow the ridiculously low expectations which society has set for teens to rob you of some of the very best years and most productive years of your life. And so, young people, these lessons are actually aimed at you. And that's not a bad thing, I hope, because I hope it's an encouraging thing to you. But I also see in this a message for every one of us to wake up to the realization of how inclined we are and how easy it is to allow ourselves to be molded more by our culture and our age than we are by what God is telling us. Bill Malone, Tennessee Bill, recently returned from a photo safari in Africa. And some of you have seen some of the pictures that of wildlife that he's posted on the internet. And he said if he never saw another wildebeest in his life, it would be too many, too early. And a few months ago, our own brother Nathan Ingram fulfilled one of his lifelong dreams by taking a hunting safari to Africa. And almost are among the most impressive animals that either of them saw was the elephants. And you can see pictures of them. But there is just something about seeing one up close and personal that you realize this is an incredible creation of God. You can't fully appreciate how massive they are until you're really close to one. I was blessed on my 40th birthday to be able to be in Amboseli Game Park in Kenya. And one of the things, for some strange reason, that I decided that I wanted to do was to see how close I could get to a bull elephant. And let me just say, I got closer than I should have, and he let me know. I mean, he started stamping the ground and making dust fly and his ears flapping and so forth. So I said, I got you, man. You know, I'm backing out of here. But I did get some real close pictures as I was going away. I took them over my shoulder as I was looking. The heaviest elephant on record was a bull that weighed 12 tons, and he stood 13 feet tall. And until you see one and realize how massive he is, then you can't appreciate it. When I got really close to this big bull, I realized that if I couldn't quite do it, I could almost walk under his belly without touching his belly. That's a big animal. Some countries still use elephants to do much of their heavy labor, particularly in the logging industry and pulling stumps and pulling trees and carrying logs. Certain Asian countries hold elephant festivals each year to demonstrate or celebrate the intelligence and the strength and the agility of these incredible animals. And one of the main events, at least in one of these countries that I was reading about, is they held in one of these annual festivals a tug of war between 100 men and one elephant. And guess who won every single year? The elephant won. Every year he won. The 100 men have never beat him yet. There are lots of considerations when you own an elephant, and I have to really watch myself here because I had some really funny lines that I can't give you. But if you own an elephant, one of the things that you have to consider is how are you going to keep him in your yard? And the next thing is how are you going to keep him out of the neighbor's yard and out of the neighbor's garden? Or just keep him from wandering off? And the answer is you tie a rope on his leg and put a stake in the ground and tie the rope to the stake on the other end. And he will stay. And you don't believe that, do you? But it's true. Why does that work? Well, it only will work with an elephant that has been trained. And the way that they train them is when that elephant is young, then they take him from his mother, and they put a heavy chain around one of his hind legs, and they put it to a large tree. And this young elephant pulls, and he pulls, and he yanks, and he runs to the end of that chain over and over and over for days and days and weeks until finally he gets to the point that he realizes when he feels that resistance, he stops. And then gradually, they put a smaller and smaller, rather than chain, they'll put a large rope, and then they'll put a smaller rope, and it gets to the point that they can put a really small rope around the leg of that elephant. And it gets to the point that whenever he feels the resistance, then he stops. and he doesn't pull anymore. And for the rest of his life, all you have to do is put a small rope around his leg and drive a stake in the ground. And when he gets to the end of that and he feels that resistance, he'll stop. And you think about, in a way, how sad that is. And you think of what's holding him. Well, the shackle actually has almost nothing to do with being able to hold him, because certainly that small rope could not hold that large elephant as he gets larger. One good yank and he would jerk the whole thing out of the ground or break it and he would be free. But he never does that. And he doesn't do it not because of the shackle around his leg, but because of the shackle that's been put around his mind. And now, when he feels, when it gets hard, when he feels the resistance, he stops and he quits. Now, here's a point I want to make. You teenagers and us as adults, we are in some ways like that elephant. We have an incredible God-given potential to do hard, difficult, important things, but you're held captive by a lie. You have been conditioned to stop when things get hard. And we don't even recognize it. We don't even realize it. And I want to help you see that your teen years are not a time to be wasted and to be free from responsibility, but rather that your teen years are designed to be a launching pad for the rest of your life. This will be the first in a two-part series. We'll continue it, Lord willing, next Sunday evening. But I want to talk tonight primarily about the low expectation that we have put on teenagers. When you think of the word or the idea of a teenager, what comes to your mind? Is it good or is it bad? The dictionary definition is a person between the ages of 13 and 19. That's what a teenager is. But the things that we normally think of that characterize a teenager are generally not very positive, are they? And you know what? That strikes at the very heart of the problem that I would like to address. The very fact that today's perception of teens is not very positive. Do you know that teenagers didn't always exist? It was just about the turn of the 20th century. There were a number of child labor laws that were passed to protect children from harsh conditions in factories. These laws were good because children had suffered in what we call sweatshops. And at that time, only about 1 in 10 young people between the ages of 14 and 18 attended high school. 1 in 10 between 14 and 18. But there was an unintended downside when these laws got passed. By removing children from the workforce and mandating school attendance through high school, the role of the youth as producers and contributors suddenly came to an end. Their role suddenly became almost exclusively that of a consumer. And it has remained that way until this day. That among the very largest segment of our population that people target for products is teenagers. Have an incredible amount of resources, not their own, but from their parents. And we have bought into this whole thing of consumerism for our teenagers. And so now a new stage of life appears that was not there before. 7 years suspended between childhood and adulthood. In the 1920s, we began to use the word teenage to speak of teenage clothes, teenage activities, and teenage boys and girls. Prior to that time, the word hadn't even been coined, and a teenager didn't exist. And interestingly, we assigned a teenager to childhood rather than adulthood. We had a choice, but we assigned a teenager to childhood. Now let that sink in a little bit. About two decades later, against the backdrop of depression and war, then the term teenager was born, and the first time that it was known to appear in print was in 1941 in an issue of the Reader's Digest. In earlier times, a person reaching adult size at the age of about 13 or 14 was ready for adult work. At 15, girls were marriageable age, and boys could enlist in the military at age 15. David was born in 1801 in the city of Knoxville, Tennessee, where his father was serving in the militia, the state militia. At 10 years old, David began a career at sea, 10 years old, as a naval cadet on the warship Essex. At 11, he saw his first battle. At age 12, David was given command of a ship that had been captured in battle, and he and the crew were dispatched to take the vessel with its men back to the United States. On their journey home, the captured British captain took issue with the fact that a teenager was ordering him around, and so he announced that he was going below deck to get his pistols, and he was going to stop this. Because out of respect for his position, he had been allowed to keep his pistols. And when word came to David of what was happening, he promptly sent someone down with word that if he set foot on the deck with his pistols, he would be immediately shot and thrown overboard. And this British captain decided that it was the best thing for him to do to stay below deck. His full name was David Farragut. Some of you will recognize that. He became the U.S. Navy's first admiral and a hero during the Civil War, and he started at 10 years old. And now, boosted by the affluence of America since World War II, the teen years are viewed as something of a vacation. Society doesn't expect much of anything of teenagers except just hoping they'll stay out of trouble. When you say that someone looks and acts like a typical teenager, what do they look and act like? Disinterested? Sullen? Insolent? Rebellious? Disrespectful of authority? You tell me. Self-centered? You tell me what they look like, what they act like, what we mean when we say someone acts like a typical teenager. The sad part is that the culture around teens expects less and less, and young people have risen, or more specifically, dropped to the occasion to meet those lower expectations. And in the process, we've robbed our children of some really valuable years of their life that are designed to prepare them to be successful in life. And we've just said, well, that's just a time when you can be a teen, and whatever that means. What do you think is responsible for the phenomenon around the world today of the 30-somethings living at home and letting mama take care of them? And it is. In all of the countries, other than third world countries, it is a phenomenon that's happening. Read an article some time back about Britain. Each country has their names for those that fall into that category. And the truth is that all of us tend to live up to or live down to the expectations that the significant people in our lives place on us. You know that? If you have someone who has high expectations of you and holds you to those expectations, you're going to excel in life. But if you have someone who drops those expectations and they really don't have any expectations of you, then you're probably not, unless somebody enters your life that can help you raise those expectations. Henry Ford said, whether you think you can or whether you think you can't, you're right. One of the greatest needs that any of us have in our lives, and I would say particularly young people, is for someone to have high expectations for us. For someone to enter our life and see something in us that we can't see in ourselves and spend their life spend some energy, some time in trying to encourage us and bring that out in us. Well, does the Bible have anything to say about this? And by the way, teenagers, I don't want you to feel bad in what I'm saying about this. I don't want to say it's not your fault. It's not your fault, in a way. It's our fault. Because we're the ones that have put or not put the expectations on you. Well, does the Bible have anything to say about any of this? Well, those of us who have been in Elton's class dealing with Jesus the Rabbi, we caught a glimpse of the society at Jesus' time when we heard that most of the apostles were likely younger than we had formerly thought. Right? Do you remember that? Very possibly in their early or middle teens, the apostles. But the Bible doesn't say anything about adolescents or teenagers per se. And another way to say that is, it doesn't recognize a period of life between childhood and adulthood. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 11, when I was a child, you know the verse, don't you? I spoke like a child, I thought like a child, and I reasoned like a child. But when I became a man, and I guess the question is, when do you become a man? Is it age 21? Is it age 25? Is it age 35? Well, that's pretty much up in the air. I've known some 14-year-old boys that were full-grown men, that carried the full responsibility of full-grown men. He admonishes the young evangelist Timothy, don't let anyone look down on you because you're young. And then he tells him how to keep that from happening. He says, but set an example for the believers in speech, in life, in love, in faith, and in purity. And that'd be a pretty good verse to memorize, young folks. Don't let anybody look down on you because you're young. And the way that you keep them from looking down on you because you're young is you set an example for them in the way that you live, in the way that you talk, in your faith, in your love, and in your purity. And when you do that, they won't look down on you. And you'll gain respect. And you'll gain respect early in your life. Is there anything in these passages that strikes you about God's expectation for young people? God has high expectations of young people. He has expectations of you really early in your life, that you live up to those expectations. So, the question is, whose expectations are you going to live by? You're going to take the easy way, and you're going to live by the expectations of our society today. If you're looking for an excuse to live a self-centered life, and you're looking for an excuse for childish behavior, then society's handed it to you wrapped up in a bow. And you can take it if you want to. But let me tell you something. You might like the freedom that low expectations give you, but you're being robbed. And if you take it, you're robbing yourself. And you are being robbed of something that you can never get back, some really, really valuable years in your life. If you decide to live by those childish standards, then you're cheating yourself in your life. And while we're right here, let me flip the coin over. Because society's expectations of you are so incredibly low, there's probably never been a time when anyone has had a greater opportunity to truly excel by disciplining yourself to grow up. You can be far ahead of your peers if you'll discipline your life. And you'll listen to what the Lord said, and you'll raise the bar of expectations in your life. And I want to say something else right here. I'm not trying to rob you of your childhood. It's one of my pet peeves that we live in a society that has robbed us of our childhood and our innocence of childhood because of all this hang up with sexuality. And children have to hear things that they should not have to hear now just for their own protection. And I'm really stoked about that. I'm really angry about that. And it upsets me that you don't have a period of innocence that I had in my life. And that you have to know some things that you shouldn't have to know at a really early age. And I'm not trying to rob you of your childhood, but I've got to tell you that a 20-year-old child is pretty pathetic. And a 30-year-old child is even more pathetic. See if this sounds like anybody you know. Raymond is 18 years old and lives in Baltimore, Maryland. His parents divorced when he was 14. Raymond is involved in everything you can think of. Smoking, drinking, drugs, even dealing drugs. He moves from house to house, crashing with various friends, and he struggled to hold even the most basic jobs. When he looks at the direction his life has taken, he expresses regret. When I first went to high school, my understanding was like, wow, this is the time to party. It's high school. Everybody's supposed to party in high school. I don't know, he said. I wish I wouldn't have thought that. Raymond insists he's not going to do drugs forever. He plans to sober up and get his GED and move on with his life. And someday he hopes to own a car dealership and sell BMWs. To help keep his dream alive, he subscribes to the DuPont Registry, a magazine about luxury cars, houses, and boats. When he's older, he plans to go to church more, too. I think about my future a few times a week, he says. What do I want to do with my life? Do I want to sit around and be a pothead all my life? No. So why not change now? I don't know, Raymond replies. I thought about it, but I kind of look at this as a summer to have fun and to party because I'm 18 years old and I don't have to worry about being under my mom's roof. So I can be out as long as I want. So I'm like, this will be the summer for fun. I'm going to party up and have fun this summer. And then after that, I want to sober up and get my life clean and get my life back together and straighten up. But I don't want the future to get here too quick, he said. I want to be able to live life and still have some fun. Let me ask you a question. What do you think the odds are that Raymond's going to realize? Where do you think Raymond's going to be in 10 years? I can pretty close to tell you where Raymond's going to be in 10 years. And it's not going to be good. You think he's going to own his BMW dealership? It's not going to happen. I want to believe that wasting the time of your life that God designed to be the launching pad is not what you really want to do for yourself. And I know that it's not what God wants for you. And if it matters any to you, it's not what I want for you either. I was fortunate. I had parents who didn't know that my teenage years were supposed to be throwaway years. They had some pretty high expectations of me. And I didn't always meet them. And I disappointed my folks sometimes. But that didn't cause them to lower those standards. And God hasn't lowered his. He created you. He equipped you with everything that you need to be successful in your life. But he's given you a choice. Whose standards are you going to accept and live by? Do you avoid doing the hard things in your life, and when you feel the resistance, when you feel things getting hard, do you quit? Next week, Lord willing, we're going to talk about some of those hard things that you need to be doing right now. But my question for, by way of application of this lesson is, are you putting off doing the things that you know right now you should be doing? Is there something in your life that you know that you need to be doing right now, but you keep putting it off? How long are you going to put it off? Till tomorrow? Do you somehow think that there's going to come a day where just a switch is going to flip and all of a sudden you're going to want to accept responsibility? You're going to want to do the things that are right? I can tell you that every day that you spend not doing what you know you need to do right now not only pushes that further ahead, but it becomes less and less likely that the day will ever come where you will make that commitment. That you're going to step up to the plate and you're going to accept the responsibility of being what the Lord wants you to be. And so my encouragement to you and the encouragement of everyone that's here And not just for young people. It's all of us. Is there anything in your life that you've been putting off that you know you need to do? Well, today is your day. Today is the day of salvation. And you know the next line, don't you? Tomorrow just might be too late while we stand in